On this week's 51%, find out why 2020 marks an important age. The school nurse talks about how her profession has changed over the years.
There's a heightened sense of anxiety with kids today. You know, like 1 in 4 have a diagnosed anxiety disorder.
And listen to a profile on Eleanor Roosevelt. I'm Allison Dunn, and this is 51%.
Oh, love me or leave me, let me be lonely. You won't believe me, and I love you only. I'd rather be lonely than happy with somebody else. You might find the nighttime the right time for kissing, but nighttime.
The Mount, Edith Wharton's estate in Lenox, Massachusetts, is celebrating the 100th anniversary of the author's magnum opus with a homecoming. 51%'s Josh Landes reports.
Under lock and key in the book-lined study of her palatial manor sits Edith Wharton's personal copy of The Age of Innocence.
We have many, many of her works that either have book plates or her signature or both, as with this copy. And so to finally have her own copy of The Age of Innocence join this collection of her work, it's amazing. It's incredible.
Ninka Deraut is the Mount's librarian.
We have a tremendous amount of scholars from all over the world and other people interested in Edith Wharton coming to the Mount to research the library, to really feel the books, hold the books, spend a couple of days with one book. And so, again, to have this added to our collection is truly amazing.
The book was published by D. Appleton & Company in 1920, after appearing in a four-part serialized form in the Pictorial Review magazine.
It was one of her most well-received books, I would say, and then in the next year it won the Pulitzer Prize for fiction in 1921.
Ann Schuyler is the Mount's Director of Interpretation and Visitor Services. The Age of Innocence drew heavily from Wharton's own experiences among the Gilded Age elite of New York City.
It's a great study of society at the time in the 1870s and again sort of the conflict between individual desire and love versus the norms of society and sort of the rules. And it was a very rigid society at that time. That's one of the reasons that she's writing about it. It's a society that she grew up in.
I teach it from the point of view of classism, sexism, because many of the characters represent women who are undeveloped, and also American culture.
Mary Valentis is an Edith Wharton expert who teaches at the University at Albany.
The whole idea of class in American culture and what's going on now in terms of income inequality and all that. It's like Melville. Melville never gets old because the themes and the ideas and the culture stay the same.
The story follows the travails of gentleman lawyer Newland Archer, who, like Wharton, is born into a wealthy New York City family. When confronted with a traditional marriage or a romance with a comparatively exotic Countess Ellen Olenska upon her return from Europe after her own disastrous marriage, Archer is forced to choose what shape his life will take. Again, Valentis.
The major theme of it is, and this comes from Keats's notion, heard music is sweet, but that unheard is sweeter still. In other words, is it better to consume a romance and see it through, or is it better to postpone everything and never to imagine it, to live in the fantasy world and leave it there?
Wharton wrote the book in Europe on the heels of World War I. Again, Schuyler.
Even though you would never consider this as a war novel, the impact of the war on her was huge, you know, so the whole society was changed. Lots of things had fallen away, and a whole generation in France and England particularly were gone. So she's kind of dealing with that all the time that she's writing this, what she would call historical novels.
Some saw Innocence as Wharton's efforts to return to a simpler time.
One interpretation was that it's sort of a retreat to a more nostalgic time, and she's writing about this very pretty time with pretty people and pretty dresses and pretty houses, and then that was all it is.
But Schuyler says the author's sensibilities belie a deeper meaning, down to the title.
When you really dive into the book, at the end of the book, particularly if you've read it a couple of times, there's a lot of irony, obviously, to the title. And it's not necessarily the Age of Innocence that she's talking about.
Today, consensus around what Wharton achieved with the Age of Innocence has only grown.
Everyone from Gore Vidal 30 years ago said she was undoubtedly one of America's finest. To writers today, Ta-Nehisi Coates, for example, is particularly enamored of The Age of Innocence and has written extensively about it.
Susan Whistler, executive director of The Mount, says a new generation of writers is embracing the novel.
The struggles for women to be actually seen and acknowledged, and for stories about domestic life to be given the same sort of serious treatment as, say, war stories. That struggle still continues, but they are drawing analogies between The Age of Innocence and the series Big Little Lies, and that both are not getting their due because they are dealing with very serious issues, but within the context of domestic life, and they are being undervalued because of their setting.
Wharton's personal copy isn't from the first printing.
The first edition of The Age of Innocence actually goes through 10 printings, because even after it's published, she's continuing to proofread it and to remove it and to streamline the writing and to distill it.
Again, Skylar.
By the edition that we have, which is the sixth printing, the scholars have estimated there were at least about 30 authorial revisions that have been made. So it's the bulk of the revisions have been made by the time that this particular book comes about, which is around February, March of 1921.
The book was donated to the Mount by collector Dennis Kahn to recognize the centennial of its publication, a gesture which Schuyler says answers a question Wharton scholars have grappled with for years.
There is a letter that Edith Wharton wrote to her sister-in-law, a woman named Minnie Cadwalader Jones, who was sort of her agent in New York and dealt with a lot of her business interests while she was writing The Age of Innocence. And it's dated from February 1921. And she writes, she's actually writing about the difficulties of writing a historical novel. And then she thanks Minnie for sending her the latest copy of The Age of Innocence. And you know, that most of the changes have been made in that one. And that's this very book, we think.
But this copy also raises new questions. Again, Whistler.
One other interesting mystery that this book presents is the book plate in it that is not Edith Wharton's, which is the book plate of a man named Norman Bassett.
Bassett was a philanthropist and businessman from Wisconsin, born in the late 1800s. It isn't clear how the bibliophile acquired Wharton's personal copy. He sold it in 1938 to raise money for a fund for librarians.
So all of a sudden, this mysterious man from the Midwest has been drawn into our universe, and that's been interesting trying to track that down. And there are a lot of more questions than answers at this point as to how the book got from France to Mr. Bassett and from Mr. Bassett to Dennis and Andrea Kahn. We hope to unravel that as the months progress.
Unlike Archer at the end of the book, the Mount is hoping you'll come inside and see Wharton's personal copy of The Age of Innocence, on display now for the centennial celebration of the book's publication. For 51%, I'm Josh Landes.
Joyce O'Connor has been a nurse for more than 40 years. She entered school nursing 2 decades ago and says she never could have imagined what nursing would be like today. Kate O'Connell spoke with O'Connor in Mashpee, Massachusetts.
In the olden days, when my mother was, you know, a school nurse, I think that people thought all they did was, you know, put on Band-Aids. Maybe people still think that.
Nurse Joyce O'Connor can tell you, school nursing in 2019, it's complicated. Take this summer, when police, firefighters, and EMS were called to Mashpee Middle and High School. School wasn't in session, but teachers and students were there.
They were either a victim or a helper or a hostage.
The school was running an active shooter drill. It's called an ALICE drill, alert, lockdown, inform, counter, evacuate. It's a common drill practiced in schools around the U.S. But this was an ALICE drill on a different level. This time, the simulation was made actively realistic. Police, firefighters, and paramedics flooded the campus. They assigned roles, then they assigned wounds.
Some of them were minor and some of them were quite graphic. It was like a mold of, you know, a gunshot wound or some other sort of traumatic injury. And that's what gave you sort of the vision of what you might be looking at. It was graphic.
As a school nurse, Joyce is used to moving around the school. She helps students wherever she's needed. But when there's an active shooter, Joyce knows her options are limited. She could end up trapped.
As the nurse, I can't even imagine, you know, even being in a lockdown situation, knowing that there might be people on the other side of the door who need my help, and here I am in a lockdown. But I know also that if I become harmed, I'm not going to be any help to anyone else.
A simulation on this scale can be intense.
Just to see, you know, even the police with guns out, you know, during the drill and be that close to them is unsettling. And, you know, they're the good guys.
Exposure to worst-case scenarios is part of every nurse's job. But Joyce says in this case,
it's the preparation for the unexpected that really brings you to a different level. I never know what's coming through the door. This is my
private exam room, so I do INS screening and postural screening.
Every day, Joyce treats lacerations, the flu, sprained knees, what nurses have done for decades. But Joyce is firm. School nursing has changed, and active shooter drills are just part of that.
We keep evolving as health changes, as, you know, we have Narcan in the school, for example.
Joyce wouldn't tell me if she's ever had to administer Narcan, the drug that reverses opioid overdose, but she's ready to use it. And while young people are smoking fewer cigarettes, now they're vaping, there are students wrestling with gender fluidity.
Those are issues that aren't unique to the Cape or unique to Mashpee. They're throughout every district in the Commonwealth and beyond. Yeah, that's what we're all faced with.
There's cots for resting and bright, cheery posters on the wall. Joyce's workspace is as familiar as the nurse's office in my high school decades ago. But a lot of changes in student health are invisible to the naked eye.
There's a heightened sense of anxiety with kids today. You know, like 1 in 4 have a diagnosed anxiety disorder.
Sometimes students arrive in her office too upset to talk.
This is just pictures of dogs. I'll say, what dog are you today, if a kid is kind of struggling with expressing themselves. So it's the shy dog, lonely dog, amused dog, angry dog.
Joyce tells me
dog,
that part of helping
dog,
out her students is meeting them where they're at.
What I like about adolescents is just their spirit. I love to talk to them. I love to learn about them. They're just interesting people.
What are some ways that you speak to adolescents? A lot of people don't know how to talk to teenagers, and teenagers can clam up.
I think kids appreciate you being really just honest and direct and non-judgmental. I think that's the key piece right there, the non-judgmental piece.
Joyce does what she can to make a safe space for her students, but she knows she can only do just so much.
I do think generally kids feel safe, but they know we can't guarantee safety anymore, and that's unfortunate.
It's a tough job in uncertain times. But school nurses like Joyce are at the ready and eager to help students graduate in good physical and mental health. For WCAI's Ways of Life, I'm Kate O'Connell in Mashpee.
This piece came to us via Atlantic Public Media through their media training program, the Transom Story Workshop, in Woods Hole, Massachusetts. Kate O'Connell is a recent workshop graduate. Samantha Leopold Sullivan is a Twin City sculptor whose work consists of visceral, abstracted creatures, emotional bodies, and an exploration of the visible and invisible. Her art aims to promote deeper self-understanding and provoke questioning within the viewer. KFAI's Dixie Treichel produced this audio portrait.
Most of the things that I've made have ended up being animals of sorts or figures of sorts. I'm very attracted to things that move and are alive, and always try to replicate that in some way, and how I can explore it through visual and tactile means. My name is Samantha Leopold Sullivan, and I am a sculptor. Cast iron, stitched latex, neon, glass, steel. The emotional bodies are my interpretation of what my emotions would look like if I gave them physical form, especially the really hard-to-place ones. It's not anger, it's not sadness, it's somewhere in between, it's something that I'm feeling, but I can't really get a hold of in terms of language, so I get a hold of it in terms of form. The emotional bodies are abstract creatures. Not all the abstract creatures are emotional bodies.
I am cleaning up a little bronze casting. Just a little six-legged creature. Needs some more grinding on the bottom, but right now I'm just bringing up a shine on the surface.
One piece that I consider emotional bodies is called Beacon and Barrier. They consist of two vaguely figural forms made out of stitched latex that I dyed to look like it was bruised and added some fiber on the inside to add some veininess to them. And inside of them, they have neon tubes. One of them on Beacon is in the belly. It has a warm glow. And then on Barrier, it has a glowing red spine. They have a torso and they have legs, but they don't have a head or arms. So the emotions that I convey there, Beacon is a strange kind of hope. Beacon usually sits against a wall, just softly glowing by itself. It's smaller than Barrier. It's like mother and child in terms of scale proportions. And Barrier is really, it's a struggling emotion. It's one that's not worked through enough. It's one that you can just be in for a long time and just feel very stuck. Whereas Beacon is one that maybe it's not the most pleasant emotion, but it is fully realized and expressed and emanating itself in a way that is more healthy. So the materials that I generally work with and combine in my art have been fiber and metal. They're both very resilient materials. Neon is so fragile. It's a glass tube with electrodes on the end, and inside that glass tube is a partial vacuum and a little tiny bit of a noble gas. I've been using neon both as an internal structure, like in the case of Beacon and Barrier, and then also to make external structures that then I can place in relationship with the creatures and the emotional bodies that I make. I do a fair amount of bending. To do the bending, you have to hold the tube over a torch. There's a variety of different torches, and you have to be very careful not to overheat it or underheat it or heat it too many times. Every step in the neon process, there is a lot of potential for failure. So you get used to breaking a lot of glass and working through it. Six sisters. They are very large tendrils that I made out of hand-stitched latex. They look fairly bruised, very veiny. They're very visceral, and they have a steel framework on the inside so they stand up, and if you gently touch one of them, they wiggle a little bit. And these are the emotions that we tend to really suppress and push down, like the feelings of resentment, the feelings of anger without having a specific cause. The longest one is about 30 feet long, and there's three of them that are that long and three that are about 15 feet long. When I install them, they generally emerge from some crevice in a building and take over the space. The subconscious, and perhaps the collective unconscious, does influence my work a lot. When I'm working, I tend to go for more repetitive processes like the hand stitching or some foundry processes. It just takes a long time, and you get into a zone with it where you can just let things flow, letting the piece emerge from me in a more organic manner. And in that way, I feel like I'm channeling the subconscious or the collective unconscious out into the world where we can actually see it.
That was sculptor Samantha Leopold Sullivan. With President's Day, days actually, two of them recently in our rearview mirrors, let's focus on a First Lady. Gilles Malkin brings us a profile from his Women in History series.
Throughout history, a few women have towered above others in both historic and spiritual aspects of their contributions to the world. And because of her stature, any effort to condense the story of Anna Eleanor Roosevelt into a short profile that would do her justice is doomed to very limited success. And yet, to omit her from the short list of the highest level of women in history would be to render that list permanently defective. Born a niece of President Teddy Roosevelt in Manhattan in 1884, she was the daughter of well-to-do socialites, but both her parents had died by the time she was 10, her mother of diphtheria and her father from the effects of alcohol. And so Eleanor was raised by her grandmother, Mary Livingston Ludlow, in Tivoli, New York, until she was 15, when she was sent to Allenswood Academy in Wimbledon near London, England. There, thanks to the personal interest of her teacher, Eleanor changed from an ugly duckling into the star of the school community, respected and beloved by everyone. After 3 years, she reluctantly returned to the U.S. to make her debut into society, which was hellish, since she was not a raving beauty and since she was a stranger to everyone attending. Her treasure lay elsewhere, as the world would discover to its very fortunate benefit. She met Franklin Delano Roosevelt in 1902. They were fifth cousins, and they were married in 1905, despite his mother Sarah's objections. This was to be one of the longest confrontations of Eleanor's life, as Sarah would continue her domination over the family. She virtually supplanted the role of mother that Eleanor should have played, and although Eleanor said herself, "It did not come naturally to me to understand little children or to enjoy them," she was nevertheless devastated by Sarah's oppression. During the First World War in 1917, Eleanor dedicated her time to the Red Cross, serving food to the departing soldiers, visiting the returning wounded, and helping their families obtain government assistance. In 1918, she discerned the effects of the separation she and Franklin were to have, caused in part by his taking her secretary Lucy Mercer as his paramour, and in part by Eleanor's success in her relations with other people, groups, and causes. Her concentration turned away from family to fulfill what was to be her life's work, social activism. She became one of the highest-profile people of her time, and this was an era in which most married women did not have careers of any sort. For a woman who was not glamorous, mountains of conjecture have amassed concerning numerous people in her life of both sexes with whom she may possibly have had affairs. Her great charisma and enormous heart endeared her to many people, and no one who ever met her could remain untouched by them. Her relationships, whatever they were, remained private. As FDR's years of office took place before the two-term limit that was established for any U.S. president, Eleanor was First Lady from 1933 to 1945. The First Lady cachet fitted her like a glove, and over that time she held 348 press conferences of her own, and completely changed that role from the customary function of a hostess into that of a mover and shaker. She became a champion of and the first U.S. delegate to the United Nations. She was chair of the committee that drafted the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, which became a model for the basis of all the rights of all people under international law. She helped in the formation of the National Youth Foundation that helps 4.5 million young Americans find work. She traveled the country and reported what she saw to her husband, including the fact that in the South, people of color were receiving proportionally less New Deal funding than whites. She was a tireless voice for civil rights and sent out invitations to many African Americans for White House events and advocated for equal benefits to all groups of Americans. In 1939, she resigned from the Daughters of the American Revolution when they denied Marian Anderson, the mesmerizing African-American contralto opera singer, use of their 4,000-seat Constitution Hall. The DAR had no idea of what a favor they were doing for Anderson. Eleanor arranged to have her sing instead on Easter Sunday at the Lincoln Memorial, where she electrified 75,000 people in an historic open-air concert. And it was broadcast over the radio to millions more. Eleanor co-chaired the Office of Civilian Defense, an organization that sought to provide fire protection and other war emergency measures through strengthening the democracy with civilian participation. She became an important member of the New York State Democratic Committee, by means of which she garnered the support of women for her husband. Rather than starting national organizations whenever an important cause clearly needed help, Eleanor encouraged people to start their own drives for their causes within their own communities. But she gave her all where she saw she was needed. She applied herself to the plight of the coal miners of West Virginia, going so far as adding her own income to the New Deal's first homestead community, Arthurdale, in an attempt to meet the miners' basic needs by creating a community in which they could carry out subsistence farming, handicrafts, and manufacturing. She created a rural factory near Hyde Park where local farming families could supplement their income by manufacturing items of traditional crafts. And through all this, she somehow found the time, starting in 1935, to write a daily newspaper column, right up until the end of her life. Eleanor Roosevelt became involved in many social issues to benefit the American woman, she gave her time to the Women's Trade Union League, which was dedicated to the humanizing of women's working conditions, establishing unions to protect them, limiting the work week to 48 hours, eliminating child labor, and establishing a minimum wage. She became a member of the League of Women Voters Legislative Affairs Committee, helping with women's suffrage and spreading the awareness of the fight for women's rights. One interesting aspect of Eleanor's view is that she did not support the Equal Rights Amendment, as she believed that female equality was not best achieved by defining them in terms of the rights that men enjoyed, but rather through the recognition of gender differences and needs. I have given no more than a snapshot of a unique life of unparalleled dedication in service to her country and really to the world, because it takes volumes to list and explain the myriad activities, achievements, and honors that adorned the life of Anna Eleanor Roosevelt. She died at 78 in 1962 of tuberculosis. Thank you for listening. For 51% and Women in History, I'm Gilles Malkin.
Gilles Malkin is a writer, musician, actor, composer, and advocate for people with disabilities. He lives in upstate New York. His Women in History series contains essays that depict the lives and accomplishments of women who made a difference against significant odds. Their contributions range from those of Mother Joseph, a Canadian nun who built hospitals in the Old West with her own hands, to Isabel Boyd, spy of the Confederate South. That's our show for this week. Thanks to Tina Rennick for production assistance. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. Our theme music is Glow in the Dark by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. If you'd like to hear this show again, sign up for our podcast or visit the 51% archives on our website at wamc.org. This week's show is number 1596.